de rien, ni le bien.
This is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests. In this case, a very experienced journalist. He works with The Intercept, but he's produced, I shouldn't say but, in addition, he's produced a really important case study of SEAL Team 6, the people credited with capturing and then killing bin Laden. The book, his name is Matthew Cole. The book is called Code Over Country, The Tragedy, Corruption of SEAL Team 6. And it's a great example of solid investigative journalism. He just goes back through the whole history, creation of not just SEAL Team 6, but others like it. And I want to begin by raising what, to my mind, is the fundamental question by this book, because we learn about all sorts of terrible things that these folks did in this team, and that there isn't effective regulation. There's actually one of the most startling things in this book. They kill somebody they're supposed to be liberating. And, you know, and the excuse, person named Norgrove, and the excuse is somehow, the only reason we know about it is for once the U.S. government and the British government were following it, and so you couldn't cover it up. But the rest is covered up. But I wonder, and I'll put this question to you, you say it's code over country. We say that about the police, the blue code of silence. We protect our own. But weren't these units, these basically assassination units, secret operatives, created by a country that believes in that, believes in violence, believes in expansion, believes in its military effort? Is there really a contradiction?
Well, I mean, I suppose it depends on how you view it. First, let me just say thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be a guest. You know, the title itself comes from one of the best sources in the book, or of the book, who's anonymous, in describing many years ago what the cultural flaw was within SEAL Team 6 and the larger Navy SEALs. And, you know, code over country means that they, the SEALs and the men in the unit, were putting the unit and themselves ahead of the Constitution and the United States. Now, obviously, if you are a serving member of the military, a Navy SEAL, you believe in the American flag and the U.S. military as a entity for good. And you and I can argue about that. But from their vantage point, you know, in the military's vantage point, a unit like SEAL Team 6 is your preeminent, your most elite unit set up for counterterrorism and hostage rescue. Certainly after 9/11, in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, at some point, given the amount of operations that they were conducting, they came to be more like stormtroopers. And that raises, I think, what the question you're getting at, which is, you know, what was the purpose, you know, ultimately, and was the purpose expanding empire or defending empire? You know, my book does not get into that, as it's a much larger question. I think it's a fair one, but my position and the book's position on SEAL Team 6 is, look, this is the military and the country's best, the best of the best from a military standpoint, the most elite. And so the question becomes, if they're the most elite at all of these operational and tactical things, then surely they must be held to the same elite account and standard for their ethical and moral and legal activity. Because at some point, you know, when you have a unit like this, they are, in a sense, criminals for the state, right? They are killers. They're also problem solvers, but they're doing it for the state. And so they have to be highly, highly controlled, monitored, and held accountable. And what the book sort of traces is, how loosely that was interpreted and how far away from accountability the unit got.
Well, I think those are valid points, but let me just say, in any institution, I'll take it back. I remember I worked at the LA Times for 29 years in one capacity or other, and I remember once complaining to our top editor about something, you know, really not very good that the paper had done and blew a story and got it all wrong, but didn't check it. And you know what he said to me? He said, "Too good to check." And I remember that was also his explanation of why another whole series I did on the New York Times and the Wen Ho Lee case, where some very good investigative journalists, including one who is at The Intercept now, very prominent, got involved in a really bad story. And again, the answer comes back in any institution, too good to check. And what I'm really, and I want you to talk about what your book discovered, but it seems to me these units were set up to do the dirty work, and that the superiors didn't want to look too much into it because they might not like what they find. And I want you to talk about that one. I thought it was on page 194 of your book. I thought, wow, this is really kind of the lead. The seal killed Norgrove. Those are the words. Tell us about that case. And what stuck in my mind, it is the only example where they were held really accountable. And that was because both the government of England and the United States were knowledgeable that a hand grenade from one of the SEALs had killed the captive that was supposed to be saved, right?
Right, yes. Yeah, so let's give your listeners and your audience a little context. In 2010, a British citizen, she's actually from Scotland, Linda Norgrove, who was a humanitarian NGO worker working in northern central Afghanistan, was kidnapped by a local Taliban group that has a pretty mushy definition, but was kidnapped and was going to be held for ransom. And the British government requested that the U.S. government, because they had a much larger military force, to rescue her. And as that sort of built in, as they started looking for her, one of the things that came out was that the SEAL Team 6 does not like to go in and conduct a hostage rescue or any kind of operation without having a good look at the underlying intelligence of, you know, why they should be going to a certain physical location, for example. So eventually the British government acknowledged that she was working with or for MI6 and the British Intelligence Service in Afghanistan, and that they had some kind of tracking device on her. And so they were, as the British government was handing over location data to the SEALs about where she was, SEALs were a little suspicious because it was so specific. And she was in a very mountainous area that was very remote. And so eventually they acknowledge or disclose that she has this relationship with the British government. And SEALs discover that the local group that has kidnapped her is either going to kill her or send her over across the border into Pakistan, essentially to trade her, sell her off to the bigger Taliban organization. And if she got over the border in Pakistan, there's very little chance that U.S. government would be able to get her, U.S. military would be able to get her. So they authorize a very daring, militarily daring rescue. And in the course of looking for her, one of the SEALs who was on his first deployment with SEAL Team 6 threw a grenade in a small, narrow sort of gangway, not seeing her as she was being pulled by one of her captors. And she was killed by the explosion. But in the initial minutes after she died and after the mission was over and they discovered her, the SEALs that were there believed that the captor had killed her with a suicide vest, either had exploded it himself or had been shot and it exploded after being shot. And so they quickly sort of put the story together, you know, looked at the scene. She was killed by this suicide vest and suicide bomb. And they moved on and they killed, you know, she died. It was, they were unsuccessful. They get back to their base. They discuss it. But at no point in that process do the people who, the SEAL who threw the grenade or his partner who knew that he threw the grenade, tell anyone that that's what happened. Eventually they tell their team leader that in fact they did throw a grenade and they suspect that that's probably what killed her. The team leader, who was a veteran of SEAL Team 6 for essentially 2 decades, said, you know, sit tight, don't say anything or do anything, I'll handle it. But he didn't handle it. And so meanwhile, as this is happening, the US government is telling the British government that the Norgrove's captors have killed her, and it happened during the effort to rescue her. And ultimately, President Obama called Queen Elizabeth of England and said, you know, we're very sorry, but the Taliban have you know, killed your citizen. We tried really hard. About 40 hours later, a senior military officer reviews the video footage, the drone footage over taking filming as it was, the operation was occurring, and sees a flash and sort of a throwing motion and then a flash, and starts to put together that there's some sort of problem with the SEAL story. Ultimately, he gets the SEALs to acknowledge that, in fact, they had thrown a grenade, and that the grenade was likely her cause of death. And so it ultimately came out, but that's basically almost 2 days later, after the British government had been told, you know, in no uncertain terms that her captors had killed her. And so what happens is this rare moment in SEAL Team 6 where, as you point out, they had, you know, they had made an error. They had not tried to kill her intentionally, of course. That was, you know, absolutely a mistake. But in their, the mistake came in their ineptitude, in this one SEAL's, you know, bad decision, poor decision. And the inclination to cover it up, lie by omission, lie outright, and cover up, you know, who was responsible for her death, took on, you know, sort of, this kind of event was not uncommon in the unit. The hiding of, you know, things going bad, the wall of silence, as you describe often in police departments. And Admiral Bill McCraven, who was at the time the head of commander of Joint Special Operations Command and oversaw the mission, and who had had his own troubled past with SEAL Team 6, came down very hard on the unit, because when the accountability process came, the SEALs only wanted to kick out one of the SEALs, the SEAL who threw the grenade, and then temporarily kick out a second SEAL. There were three involved. And McRaven came down and said, no, you know, I don't trust that this unit is going to take my advice or my intention that there be some accountability unless I physically come down to the base and have what they call an admiral's mast, which was it's a non-judicial punishment and process that happens in the Navy. But for an admiral to do, it's normally called a captain's mast. For an admiral to do it, and a three-star admiral at that, was unheard of. But it spoke to how serious, how little faith, frankly, that the admiral, who was himself a SEAL and who had once worked at SEAL Team 6, served at SEAL Team 6, had in the command that they would hold themselves accountable for their failures. And he then had a conference, Admiral McRaven, in which he sort of gave a direction to all of his senior officers to say, look, we have a problem at SEAL Team 6. And the problem is that there is essentially this code where they protect each other and the unit before they follow the mission and follow the Constitution and the principles of the country. And again, you know, this is the military, so it's, the terms are very patriotic and spoken that way. But that's actually where the title comes from, as one of my sources was describing this very important moment, this very dramatic moment in 2010, where he was saying, look, what we have in my community is a code over country. And that's actually where I got the title for the book. And it is, as you said, one of the few times. I mean, I think, you know, the book highlights several events and incidents of alleged criminal activity, war crimes, and wrongdoing. And, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is that these are incidents that were known and were caught. And it was sort of retells how the SEALs engaged in cover-ups to avoid accountability and getting exposed. But there are so many scenarios and incidents that we'll never know about or do not know about yet because they didn't rise to the level of needing a cover-up. And that is really the danger of allowing the leaders and the officers, senior officers who sort of oversaw the unit during this time, allowing them to rise as they have into 2, 3, and 4-star admirals.
Well, you know, you've just given that's really a compelling story. And I just want to add, though, the lead really is we only know about that one because the governments of England and the United States on the highest level, the president, you know, and so forth in our country, were knowledgeable about it. The rest of the time, your book recounts, you know, basically a rogue force, quite barbaric. I mean, rivaling, thugs in human history. I mean, on every level. I mean, what do you call the canoeing, for instance? Is that a common phrase, canoeing, that's described in your book?
Common in what way? I mean, it's an action or activity that certainly became popular in the post 9/11 wars, and was the name itself was popularized within SEAL Team 6.
But I mean, are they special? I mean, they'll tell readers what that is, because I mean, it's really on the level of a certain kind of savagery that we don't normally associate with, right?
Sure. Let me just before I get into describing it and give your readers a bit of a warning because it's graphic. You know, what I tried to do in this book is not just, you know, the reality is that SEAL Team 6 and units like it, the only other one really is Delta Force in the U.S. These are, as I said, the most elite fighters, servicemen, commandos that the U.S. government and the U.S. military employs. They train, they spend millions of dollars training an individual member of SEAL Team 6 and maintaining that operator and that SEAL over the course of their career. I mean, literally millions of dollars to train and maintain them for a 20-year career. So
when you say elite in training, let's just be clear. They're not training them in some high ethical code of warfare. They're not training them in respect for the countries that they're visiting. I mean, in your book, you describe when these folks were in Iraq or anywhere else, the civilian population was treated as, you know, just the enemy, in Afghanistan as well. So the training does not include sensitivity to other human beings or respect for their culture or, you know, the limits on warfare in a civilized society. You're talking about their ability to stand in cold water and keep their ammunition dry and endurance and fighting, right?
Yes. Yeah, the primary skill is knowing whom to kill and whom not to kill. And the definition of that is who is a target and who isn't a target, who is a threat and who isn't a threat. And they, you know, operating within the guidelines of the U.S. military code of justice and the rules of engagement that the Pentagon puts in place for a conflict, they are the best at determining, you know, who to kill and whom not to kill, right?
Doesn't your book contradict that? The rules of engagement don't say you go up to a prisoner and blow his head off when he's already in captivity and then lie about it, conceal it. Your book is rife with stuff that can't possibly be in the code of behavior.
Absolutely. But those incidents and the events that are in the in the book are not by, you know, numerically and in terms of quantity, don't reflect the majority of events, right? The majority of operations. And so they are more than anomalies. The book is really about this sort of culture. I mean, it's really, I would like to think of it as a virus that was inside SEAL Team 6, which was, you know, one of the things that we haven't reckoned with, and this is, you know, I think this is a really crucial point. I've made it several places in the book, is that the 20-year period after 9/11 that we've just, you know, you can argue whether we've ended simply because we withdrew from Afghanistan or whether the sort of forever war goes on, happens to be a unprecedented run of war for Americans, right? For service members, for members of these two units, Delta Force and SEAL Team 6, and my book focuses on SEAL Team 6, no one in the history of American warfare that I know of, that anyone has suggested, has experienced or gone through and taken, seen as much violence and warfare as these men. And so one of the things that is different here is we know that war and exposure to war and violence, you know, has an enormous amount of side effects for the psyche, for mental health, for health, right? Well, but no one knows what it's done for guys who have done, let's say, 15 military deployments in which the kind of military fighting that they do is not from a tank, it's not from a plane. They're not shooting from, they're not shooting rockets from far distances. This is up close violence. They are storming into compounds and homes, buildings, and they're killing people at close range, and they're being fired at close range. And so one of the things that I think this book tracks is the secondary and tertiary effects of that kind of, I mean, I want to say trauma. And what happens is that, you know, the history of war is replete with war crimes and savagery. Over time, you know, the international system has incorporated with the Geneva Conventions and the International Criminal Court the idea that there are laws and rules of war of which the U.S. military personnel have to adhere. I would not describe SEAL Team 6 as a unit that operates outside of, as a you know, they operate within the laws of war as their basis. What happened after 9/11, though, was that some members of the unit, and unfortunately too many members of the unit, went beyond those laws and those norms, well outside of them, and were never held accountable for it. So I'm not, the book doesn't make the argument that every member of SEAL Team 6 was a war criminal, not the case at all, but a not insignificant number were. And committed war crimes. But the argument the book really makes is that is to some extent to be expected if you send guys out for 15 to 20 years of continuous fighting. The responsibility is for those in command and the leadership who knew about it or set the stage and the environment for those that misconduct to occur. And that's the real, you know, cancer, if you will, the real virus is that those in command, those who had by law were are required to uphold the good order and discipline of their men and the men under their command, failed to do so.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
I understand your effort to show the stress that they're under, their complexity and all that. But couldn't that be said of any terrorist group, Al-Qaeda or anybody else? I mean, they don't have tanks. They're out there. They're, you know, just them and some actually usually primitive weapon. If they're captured, it turns out they will be tortured by our side and brutalized by our side. So as a rationalization for war crimes, the stress of combat, even, you know, as I say, yes, these people were, in a very exposed situation, but so were the people that they were sent to kill. Now they said, oh, well, we're on the right side. But the other people say they're on the right side.
I'm not rationalizing their behavior. I'm trying to explain where some of it comes from the human side.
Yeah.
And the reality is that where they where members of SEAL Team 6 broke the law, they should have been held to account, and they weren't. No one here is arguing that it's okay to desecrate bodies or to unlawfully kill people. And did they do those things? Yes, they did. The question is where does it come from? How does it happen? And I think that you know, that I've heard varying versions of this story, which is, you know, look, if you did 13 or 14 deployments as an operator and you killed people most nights during the 3-month tour deployment that you did, it got boring. And so one of the things you did is you found ways to make it more entertaining and sort of raise the adrenaline, kick the adrenaline in, get the adrenaline rush for it. Now, you know, as a journalist, you know, I want to know what the effects are of that and what does that look like for American personnel operating as an American, as a person. It's, you know, it's a really scary and awful thing to consider that's how humans may operate, and that, you know, Americans wearing an American flag patch and a U.S. uniform, you know, do things like shoot people in the head in a specific way to leave essentially a calling card mark, a desecration, to let the enemy know that, you know, they were there. And that's what canoeing was.
Yeah, splits the skull so you expose the brain. That's what your book is, very graphic in a description of it. It's compelling. The book, by the way, is Code Over Country. And it doesn't gross you out to read it. I don't want to turn people off. But the fact is, you make it very clear that on the level of what we call savagery anywhere else by anybody else, this is a savage practice. You are deliberately splitting the skull, right, of a person who presumably is dead, not always, to see the brain and then take pictures of it. That we would consider a very primitive, savage behavior in any study of any other culture. But I do want to stick to a central point here. When you create secret operations like this, when you cover it up, this, whether it's your local police department or anything, and any country in the world, you are doing it because you're expecting them to do activities that you would otherwise be embarrassed by. You don't want to be held accountable. And so you have these teams, whatever you call them, and you expect them. The reason they are so secret is not just because they have to catch the enemy unawares, but you really, again, I get back to that too good to check. You really don't want to know a lot of the stuff they're doing. And let me bring up the most, you know, the most publicized case of SEAL Team 6 was what the capture and killing of bin Laden. Your book makes it sound like the killing of bin Laden, which after all is not what U.S. is supposed to be about. You're supposed to capture these people, have trial, learn what they did, and so forth. He ends up getting assassinated. Your book makes it sound like that was part of the plan.
Which part was part of the plan? The killing?
To kill him.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. There's no question.
But there's something the U.S. government has denied to this day. They say no, you know.
Right.
Let me point out, by the way, in your book, you say he wasn't carrying a gun. Well, a lot of the media reports said bin Laden had a gun, he was shooting, and you say he was unarmed and there was just family members around, and yet he was killed. Now, it would have been really important to find out what this guy thought, to have a trial. You know, same thing with the people in Guantanamo. If they are the bad people messing up this whole world, why not use the best thing about supposedly the American experiment, a rule of law, find out who they are, let them have defense, have a trial, so we can avoid other bad guys at the very least, right? And in your book, you say, no, this SEAL Team 6, and that must be with the full authorization of the U.S. government on the highest level, planned to get him and kill him. It was an assassination team.
That's exactly right. That's what they asked them to do. That's what they signed up to do. And there's no question that in the aftermath and the publicization of the killing of bin Laden, the Obama administration, you know, absolutely misled the public about what their intent or hope was when they got into the compound. There's just no question about that. In interviews that I had with members of SEAL Team 6, top and bottom, including those who were on the raid, there was absolutely no ambiguity about it. They were first briefed and they were told, listen, you're going to go in and you're going to kill him and you're going to bring his body back out. In fact, that was one of the senior leaders of SEAL Team 6 who I quote in the book said that was precisely how they discussed it. You're going to go in, you're going to kill him, you're going to drag his body out. That's it. And the fiction of the notion of capturing was just that. It's a fig leaf to give the lawyers who were in the Obama White House at the time, you know, the ability to deny that it was an illegal assassination in a foreign country, which, you know, it no question it violated international law. Not that the American public, you know, not that it would have been politically unpopular. But there was no effort to capture him. There was no plan to capture him. There was only a plan to kill him.
Well, he was captured, and he was not a threat at that point. And actually, he could have been brought back. And you could have actually, one of the great things supposed to be about our society is we think the truth in any situation matters. And the more knowledge you have, the more secure we are. And we want to know, who are these terrorists? What drives them? And here you had the premier figure who, after all, had a lot to talk about his relation to the Saudi government. You know, he came from a ruling class family in Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers were good Saudi citizens. What was his relation to other terrorist movements and so forth? What made him tick? This is stuff that, if you talk about a democratic society, would have informed us, the public, about it. And yet, here we had at the highest level, our president on down lied to us about the death of bin Laden. And we accept this lying as some normative. And really, that's what you're suggesting here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of evidence that the, you know, this was done, the operation itself was done under what the government calls a Title 50 authority, which gives the president and the CIA the authority essentially to lie to the public as part of covering an intelligence activity for the effectiveness. And I know that Seymour Hersh has written, you know, extensively about the bin Laden raid. I have some reporting that supports parts of it, which were that the Pakistanis were aware that he was there, and it was at their request and their insistence with the Obama administration that if the SEALs were going to come in and do something, he was not to be captured. He'd have to be killed. And so that was part of the agreement between them. I will say I don't get into that part in the book. I focus on, you know, one thing I'm pretty comfortable and confident about is that SEAL Team 6 was not privy to many of the upper echelon discussions behind the bin Laden raid. They knew very little other than where to find them and what to do with them.
Well, that's why I'm pushing this, because I think they're the fall guys. That doesn't excuse their behavior. But, you know, and their defense, I'm sure, of anything that you would judge a war crime or, you know, or anything else would be, hey, the higher ups really knew what we were about. That's what we were basically trained to do. And we are an assassination squad. And why are you, this happened with the whole torture reports, you know, and it's a similar point. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's waterboarded, 187 times, is to make him incoherent. Well, I'd like to know, how did you go from being a student in North Carolina to this killer, you know, of Americans from Afghanistan and plan the whole thing? And it seems to me, the real issue here is suppression of truth about it. You know, bin Laden was an embarrassment. He's somebody who was recruited to fight the Russians. You know, he was part of the group to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. He had a lot of dealings that Al-Qaeda did with Pakistan and other governments as well, including maybe the Saudi government. And so these people that did, as reprehensible as they are, had stuff to tell. And they're being alive and in captivity and maybe having a trial before they're waterboarded 176, maybe they would present an inconvenient truth about how 9/11 and where did terrorism come from? And you know, and that's what I thought was sort of amazing in that description, that he was not killed to save the lives of the SEALs. He was killed as an act of policy.
Yeah, this was a state sanctioned assassination, and yes, you know, your description of SEAL Team 6 ultimately as an assassination unit, it is absolutely part of their portfolio, and insofar as they're a tool and instrument of the U.S. government, they are often fall guys. And in fact, actually, one of the things that I write about in the book is that the SEAL operators, the enlisted guys who conducted the bin Laden raid, one of the reasons why a few of them chose to cash in and sell their stories as inaccurate and untruthful as they were in certain parts was because they had come to the conclusion that the admirals and the civilian politicians, you know, ran campaigns and made money in their post-military careers based off of and on the backs of their grunt work, if you will, that there was essentially a class divide, and they understood that the elites benefited from the operations that they conducted. And you know, to the extent then that the elites and those in charge don't want to know the gruesome details about how these men operate, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I try to, you know, going back a little bit before to describing how members of SEAL Team 6, you know, during the wars could end up committing war crimes, I wasn't trying to rationalize their exposure to violence. But it is important to understand how things occur for them, what their perspective and you know, one of the things that happens, unfortunately, for the public, and one of the things that is about this, is at the core of this book, is trying to fix the narrative in the public that the public consumes about the Navy SEALs and SEAL Team 6, which is one that is, you know, unambiguously heroic. You know, it very much looks like a television in Hollywood story. It's, you know, sheer patriotism and goodness in defense of American freedom. And the reality looks a lot different. And you have to strip away most of the politicization of these issues to get at, just to understand brick by brick, okay, you know, if you're a member of SEAL Team 6, what you are is you're a highly trained, highly skilled craftsman, okay? And your craft is killing. That there's no two ways about that, and there's no reason to butter it up. And once you have that as your context, you understand when they operate in a war zone or on a military operation, their context and how they make decisions looks very different than how it gets portrayed after the fact to the public. And so what I've tried to do with Code Over Country is establish and detail all of the context to understand, for instance, why Chris Kyle, who wrote the American Sniper book and which became a movie, was such a troubling figure, and not the person that he portrayed himself as, and not the person that both the book and the movie have portrayed him as. But you can't get to that unless you understand the environment that he was operating in and the kind of unit that he was working with.
You know, we're going to wrap this up, but I think this is a sort of fundamental question. Anytime you get into this deep, secret, dark world, bad things happen because you're not accountable. And we don't really you know, it's interesting. We only learned about the torture program that was really widespread and an incredible stain on America. You say stain, maybe it again is normal in too many times. But the guy who first really broke that story, John Kiriakou, who had been in the CIA and actually been involved in the capture of the most, you know, important Al-Qaeda person at that time, he went to prison for actually saying the name of somebody who was not undercover, who happened to be in the CIA, and they punished with them. They tried to put him away for 3 decades, but he served a couple of years, lost his pension, everything else, you know. Yet, in your book, you got the SEALs who you would think should be protected in terms of their names and everything. There must be a lot of bad folks out there in the world who would like to get at the people who captured bin Laden. And yet their identity, you know, first of all, this capture was used to justify torture in a movie, Zero Dark Thirty, which actually had the blessing of the CIA. Some of these SEAL team people were brought when Panetta, a good Democrat, was the head of the CIA and was exposed to an audience that didn't have security. And then they go on and write books and everything and about it to celebrate it. And none of that seems to get them thrown in jail. It's only the people who have a negative view of this activity that when they write about it and talk about it and having served, they get punished severely. Isn't that really what's the case here?
Sure. And I think that goes to a larger question of, you know, the sort of elites versus the, you know, those in power versus those who are lower down. And, you know, where your views jive or conflict with those in power. And, you know, when you are pushing a message that is consistent with what those in power are trying to portray, you don't really have any problems, or you have fewer problems. And when you are pushing a message that goes against, you know, or conflicts with what those in power and the elites are trying to convey, you make powerful enemies.
Well, I guess that's the takeaway from this book. Is there anything I've talked a lot and, you know, anything I've missed that people should know? They should certainly read the book and buy it, Code Over Country, The Tragedy Corruption of SEAL Team 6. It's a bold type book. Love that name. But it really, you rarely get an insight into an issue to people like this one. It's so shrouded in secrecy. The journalism is A++++. You get people to talk to you. You look at the data that was mostly denied to us. So this, I hope this is a bestseller. Matthew Cole, Code Over Country, The Tragedy Corruption of SEAL Team 6, but I think it's the corruption of the country and not just the corruption. Maybe that's what we've been going back and forth a little bit on. Do you want to add anything that I've missed?
No, I really appreciate you reading the book. I really appreciate you having me on. I think, you know, one of the things that one of the purposes of writing this book was that now that the war on terror, so-called war on terror, is over, and I say that in quotes because I understand that it's only over in a certain sense, it is time, really time, to start taking stock of what occurred over the last 20 years. And because understanding, you know, what has happened historically gives us a sense of where we are now and where we're going to go as a country. And what Code Over Country charts is the story of the Navy SEALs and the creation of SEAL Team 6, and then its rise after 9/11 to this world famous military unit, and what the consequences of that are. And one of the points I do make, and I want to make to your readers, is that you know, the American people have a responsibility, and they carry the burden for anything and everything that is done in their name on foreign lands by people in uniform. And so when you have criminal misconduct and war crimes and otherwise unethical and immoral conduct, it's a stain on our nation. And we collectively have to sort of carry that burden. And so it's necessary for us, I think, to know what happened, just to understand, not necessarily to put people in prison or to prosecute, but just to understand what occurred in our name. And so I think that's, you know, that's why I hope people will buy the book and read it.
And it should be said that the barbarism that is described in this book is also a recruiting tool for more terrorists to attack us. Doesn't justify what they do, but the fact is, in any serious account of what caused, you know, people like those 15 good citizens of Saudi Arabia to get involved in with bin Laden or bin Laden himself from a prosperous family, is a sense of outrage of what they claim was done to their culture and their people. So there's blowback. And if you want to know why there's blowback, read Code Over Country and learn about canoeing. All right, that's all the time we have for Sheer Intelligence today. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for hosting these shows, Joshua Sheer, our executive producer who found our guest today and had this whole idea, Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who does the introduction, and Lucy Berber, who writes the transcription, and a special thanks to the JWK Foundation, in the name of a terrific writer, Gene Stein, who helps support the show. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.